There's a place on the internet where almost 2 billion of us regularly go, many of us several times a day. Facebook, the social networking site which Mark Zuckerberg started in his university dorm room and which has grown in little over a decade into one of the most valuable companies in the world. Some people say it's the most powerful company that's ever existed, because of the way we let it into our lives, our biggest days, our smallest moments, the best times, and the worst. It's a digital space where we can share information and news, but one that's shaped and controlled by the technology giant and its powerful computer code. I know I'm not alone in wondering just how much Facebook knows about me and what it's doing with that information. I'm Ruth Alexander, and this is The Inquiry, and we want to know, how powerful is Facebook's algorithm?
Part 1. The Secret Sauce.
What does the algorithm look like then? You have glanced at the code. What does it look like?
It just looks like a lot of computer code. I mean, it's really, you know, visually, it's pretty boring. It's
numbers,
it's
a, letters. It's a,
right.
Our first expert witness, Willa Remus, a technology writer at Slate magazine, is one of the very few to have glimpsed the Facebook algorithm.
It was a rare opportunity, and the algorithm remains a very closely guarded secret because it really is at the core of their company's value. This is their secret sauce, so to speak. These are their trade secrets.
It's the computer code, the set of instructions that makes Facebook work. The company let Willa Remus in so he could write an article about it, but kept him on a tight leash.
At one point, I said that I needed to use the bathroom, and they said, oh, sure, no problem. We'll just walk you over there. So they walked me over to the bathroom and then stood outside.
He was then granted access to the heart of the company, though, to meet the team who work on the algorithm.
It was surprising how small the team is. It's several dozen engineers and product managers working in this giant open office in Menlo Park. A lot of them are at standing desks all day. A few of them are sitting down. They're mostly young people in their 20s and 30s, more men than women. And what they're doing all day is combing through spreadsheets and databases to figure out what's working and what's not working.
When Facebook started up in 2004, it was a lot simpler than it is today. You just had a page on which you could post comments and photos, and you could visit your friends' pages and see what they were posting and comment on their stuff too. But then, in 2006, Facebook decided to introduce the news feed.
It was a feed that would tell you about what your friends were doing on Facebook, that John had just posted on Susie's wall, or Susie liked Mark's status update, and you could see what that status update was. This was a new idea on the web, and it scared people, and there was actually a massive backlash.
Thousands signed a petition demanding that Facebook stop invading its users' privacy. The website stuck to its guns. The protests melted away, and the news feed, powered by the top-secret algorithm, is now central to the Facebook experience.
Every time you open Facebook, the algorithm is going to run a search. It's going to collect all the posts by everybody you follow, your friends, the pages you follow, the celebrities, the publications. And then it's going to run a series of predictions for each of those posts. How likely it is that you would hit like on this post? How likely is it you would comment on this post? How likely is it you would share it with others?
The post which appears at the top of your newsfeed is the one the algorithm has calculated you'll be most interested to see. The algorithm's making these decisions based on your past activity. Facebook began to get a sense of our individual tastes when it introduced the like button, allowing us to register our pleasure at seeing particular photos and posts.
Once you could tell Facebook, I like this, I like that, then Facebook could use that as a strong signal to predict what you're going to like in the future.
I thought I was telling my friend, oh, I like your photo, I like your status update. But from Facebook's point of view, I was telling them that's what I like.
And that's the beauty of Facebook from a business perspective. It's like there's a shadow purpose to everything you do as well. And every action that you take on Facebook doubles as a source of data for Facebook to get to know you better.
As well as the like button, users can now use emoticons to express anger, sadness, laughter, amazement, or love, and indicate which friends they want to hear more from, which less. In spending time on Facebook, giving away clues about our likes and dislikes, we give the algorithm enormous power.
Part 2. Filter bubble.
I grew up in a very small rural town of 900 people. And when I first got online, all of a sudden I was in this online space with people from all over the world. For a kid who was 13, who was kind of a nerd in a small town, that was about as amazing as it gets.
Our second expert witness, Eli Pariser, founder of the news website Upworthy, has made his career out of the internet.
I still think there are many amazing things about this platform, but in a weird way, we're all kind of back to being stuck in our own virtual small towns.
To understand what Eli Pariser means, we have to track back a few years to 2009, when he decided to have a little fun with his Facebook newsfeed.
Was a little tired of just seeing the same old stuff from my friends who I already agreed with, so I decided to do a little bit of an experiment.
A self-confessed lefty, Eli Pariser set out to befriend people on Facebook on the right of the political spectrum, people who didn't think like he did, so he could challenge his own views. But then, after a while, he noticed something strange.
I sat down and loaded my Facebook feed, and I was really looking forward to seeing this feed with, you know, my friends from the right posting some things and my friends from the left posting others. But as I scanned, I realized that my friends from the right weren't in the mix. It was kind of like a little mini mystery, which was, where did they go?
Eli Pariser started to look into how the Facebook algorithm worked.
And that was when it all kind of started to click, because I realized that they were being edited out.
Because he hadn't been liking and clicking on the right-wing content his new friends were sharing, Facebook's algorithm presumed Eli wasn't interested in seeing their posts.
You're not clicking on the right-wing news as much as you are on the left-wing news, and so let's dial up the left-wing news sites for you, Eli. And that happens invisibly. There's nowhere where it tells you that it's doing that or warns you that it's doing that.
Eli Pariser's mind began to boggle with the significance of what he'd discovered.
It's almost like the Copernican shift in reverse, where instead of realizing, oh, the world doesn't revolve around me, it's realizing like, oh, actually, my information universe, it all revolves around me, and I didn't know it.
In other words, many of us are now unwittingly living in a world shaped largely by our personal beliefs, thanks to the personalized experience Facebook's algorithm tries to give us. Eli Pariser wrote a book and called it
The Filter Bubble.
He says it's not just Facebook's algorithm that creates the filter bubble. It's Google's, for example, too, with the way it offers us search results based on what we've searched for in the past. He says Facebook's filter bubble is significant.
Because in the United States and many other societies, Facebook is increasingly the top source of news for big chunks of the population. So if they're only seeing news that reinforces their own political viewpoint, it leads us to a place where there's no sense of shared facts. We're all in very different information universes.
Haven't we always lived in our own bubbles, though?
But this is different for a couple reasons. First, it's invisible. So when I pick up The Guardian in the UK, I know where The Guardian's coming from. I can kind of adjust based on that editorial filter. I don't know who Facebook thinks I am, and therefore it's very hard for me to adjust. I think the second piece is publishers have realized that they can actually, you know, get a lot of clicks out of Facebook by tailoring to these very narrow, very partisan audiences.
Facebook's algorithm, Eli Pariser argues, has the power not just to shape millions of people's online universes, but to shape the media too, making it
much more fragmented and much more partisan than it was 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Designed to expand our social networks and to bring people together, Facebook and its algorithm, Eli Pariser says, could be making us more divided. But what if the Facebook algorithm doesn't just know what we like, but also knows what we are like?
This is The Inquiry. I'm Ruth Alexander. I recently made another edition of The Inquiry with James Fletcher to find out why can't we stop looking at our phones. It's available to download.
Part 3. Getting to know you.
Well, today I had many, many meetings. Started at 10, and there was one at 10:30, then there was one at 11, and then there was about a meeting at 1.
These days, our third expert witness, David Stillwell, can often be spotted dashing about Cambridge on his bike. He's a lecturer in big data and quantitative social science at the university. He calls himself a computer nerd, but the university prefers to think of him as the Mark Zuckerberg of psychometrics, the measurement of personality. Here's what happened.
So in 2007, basically I had nothing to do in the summer.
David Stillwell had just finished his undergraduate degree in psychology and was waiting to start a PhD. Not one to sit about twiddling his thumbs, he used his psychology degree to design a personality test and turned it into a Facebook app, the My Personality app.
And I literally just shared it with my friends, and I was watching the numbers about how many people were using the app. At the beginning, there were 5 or 10, and then every time I refreshed the page, you know, the number kept going up.
And up, and up. 6 million people took the test. In his summer holiday, David Stillwell had inadvertently created a massive database of human psychological profiles, one of the richest sources of information social scientists have ever seen. The 6 million people had all answered a questionnaire which measured key personality traits: openness, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism. And many had also agreed to share their Facebook information.
So we ended up with a big data set about not only what makes people unique from their personality scores, but also what are people actually doing on Facebook. And that's where we started being able to do some really interesting research looking at the two.
David Stillwell set about building a computer algorithm that tried to predict a participant's personality based on their Facebook likes and compared that to the questionnaire they'd filled in about themselves and questionnaires their Facebook friends had filled in about them too. The results were amazing.
Just given 9 Facebook likes, then the computer algorithm can predict your personality as accurately as your coworker can. If you've got 65 Facebook likes, then the computer can predict as accurately as a friend. If you've got about 125 Facebook likes, then the computer algorithm can say, you know, you're extroverted or introverted as well as a family member. But the average person's got about 225 Facebook likes, which is almost as accurate as the prediction that a spouse would make. So in that respect, the computer or the algorithm knows you almost as well as your husband or wife.
Wow. Even the most innocuous likes are apparently very telling.
People low in the agreeableness personality trait are more likely to like the Prada brand on Facebook. So it turns out the film is true, so the devil wears Prada. Also camping, for example, it was correlated with things like conscientiousness, introversion.
So the Facebook algorithm might know that you like camping and Prada, and David Stillwell's research might allow an advertiser to figure out that that means you're introverted and disagreeable too. David Stillwell says there's no evidence that Facebook's using your activity to make a psychometric profile of you, but it could do, and other companies certainly already are. He's worked with some himself.
What we provide to the brand is the list of keywords that they might want to use to target their adverts at different psychologies. We've looked at, can we sell the same hotel in 2 different ways based on the recipient's personality? So if we know the recipient is a kind of a family person, then we'll market that hotel in a way that makes it sound like, you know, this is a place you can take your family and it will have fun and the kids will have fun. If it's an extroverted person, then we might say, this is a very cool place, it's a party place.
So the hotel group can tell Facebook to put its advert aimed at introverts in the newsfeed of campers, and the advert aimed at extroverts in the newsfeed of people who like partying. A few months ago, one UK insurer announced it would price customers' car insurance based on their Facebook activity.
Saying the word excited may suggest that you're ever so slightly more likely to be extroverted and ever so slightly less likely to be a good car insurance risk. Once you start using exclamation marks and you're saying things like so awesome, then together they're all adding up to potentially a consistent signal.
But Facebook blocked the insurer's move, citing privacy concerns and that it had clear guidelines that prevent a user's Facebook information being used to make decisions about eligibility. But David Stilwell says, played right, our Facebook information could prove valuable to us, as well as to the companies that want to target us.
The future could be that these companies, these algorithms, are like your personal butler, so they understand you best, they can find you the best products for you, and they can provide those products in a way which is most likely to be interesting for you.
But he also says there is a danger the information we give out on Facebook could be used against us. Most of us don't really understand just how much we're giving away about ourselves on Facebook and how that information's being used. And as our next expert witness warns, it's not just companies who might be using Facebook's algorithm to really get to know us, it's politicians too.
Part 4. Data danger.
Our final expert witness, Cathy O'Neill, is a mathematician who quit her finance job on Wall Street.
I saw really bad stuff going on.
She's since written a book, Weapons of Math Destruction.
Realizing that they were everywhere, these algorithms that people trusted because of their mathematical authority, but that were actually taking advantage of people.
She's in no doubt about the power of Facebook's information-gathering algorithm for companies with something to sell.
Facebook has given them the opportunity to go straight to a certain individual and a personality type.
And it's not just retailers who have something to sell.
Blanket advertising is dead.
This is Alexander Nix, the chief executive of Cambridge Analytica, speaking at a Concordia business conference in New York in the autumn. His London-based company claims to have influenced the US presidential election.
Cambridge Analytica, what they were suggesting they were doing was understanding everyone who voted in the United States in terms of their personality types.
If you know the personality of the people you're targeting, you can nuance your messaging to resonate more effectively with those key audience groups.
So the idea was that they were going to use those profiles, called psychometric profiles of voters, to decide what message to send to those voters.
So, for a highly neurotic and conscientious audience, you're going to need a message that is rational and fear-based or emotionally based. In this case, the threat of a burglary and the insurance policy of a gun is very persuasive.
Alexander Nix points to a political campaign advert that states the Second Amendment right to bear arms isn't just a right, it's an insurance policy. After Donald Trump won the election, this company sent out a statement claiming their personality profiling techniques had helped him win. Some people have said Cambridge Analytica have used data from Facebook users' profiles, but Cambridge Analytica denies it. Cathy O'Neill isn't sure how effective this kind of campaigning has been so far, but she says Facebook is the perfect place for politicians to minutely target people, and that these methods will become more effective. Here's how it could confuse a voter into voting against their political instincts, she says. Take a conservative politician in the US with whom Cathy O'Neill disagrees on all points except one.
If Rand Paul's campaign wanted to target me, they would send me the message saying, oh, Rand Paul wants to break up the big banks. So do you. And that's true. I do want to break up the big banks. So I would think to myself, huh, Rand Paul sounds pretty good. Why don't I check him out? And I would go to his website, and they would follow me with cookies.
Cookies are downloaded onto your computer when you visit a website. When you visit the site again, it then knows you've been there before.
They'd say, oh, we know who this is. This is Cathy, and we know what she thinks. So let's only show her what we want her to see. So it would be very difficult for me to find good information about Rand Paul if I had to rely on Rand Paul's campaign.
We're not saying Rand Paul is doing this, by the way. It's just an example of how campaign targeting could work. And psychometric profiling could even be used to stop people voting, Cathy O'Neill says.
That's when it gets really scary, is when the campaigns have the ability to send whatever kind of information they want to a given person, including the opposition. We have no way of tracking that.
The inventor of the World Wide Web, Sir Tim Berners-Lee, has recently warned that political campaigning on the internet needs tighter regulation, saying that campaigns sent out as many as 50,000 personalised variations of their ads each day on Facebook during the presidential campaign.
We don't know what those advertisements were, and Facebook will not show them to us. The problem is that we have no tools at this point. There are no laws against this.
We did ask Facebook for an interview, but it declined our invitation. If, by this point, you're worried about how Facebook's algorithm is changing our world, take a step back, Cathy O'Neill says, and look at the bigger picture. Because it's not just Facebook's algorithm that's wielding huge influence. Powerful algorithms are everywhere.
We have algorithms that assess teachers. We have algorithms that tell police where to go. We have algorithms that tell judges how long to sentence criminal defendants to in jail. We have algorithms that decide who gets an interview at a job, how much you're going to pay for insurance, whether you're going to get a credit card. And so it's all over the place.
Maybe these algorithms are leading to better decision making.
Sometimes they could be.
The problem, she says, is that no one really understands what's going into the algorithms, into the black box. And what's in there is not as scientific and objective as many people assume.
Algorithms are opinions embedded in math, embedded in formal code. So they are some person's viewpoint on what is valuable, what is important.
Cathy O'Neill has set up a company to help industry regulators audit algorithms. She admits they're not banging down her door for help, though. But she's convinced this will change.
In the next 5-10 years, we're going to have a new regulator that is in charge of algorithms that helps every single regulator make sure that the algorithms involved in their specialty are fair and accountable. We will have to do that, or else we'll just be slaves to the machine.
How powerful is Facebook's algorithm? The answer, it seems, is very powerful. In trying to serve us only what it thinks we'll like, it's invisibly filtering the information we encounter. And as it learns from the data we willingly provide, it's getting to know us as well as our friends, even our partners. That makes it easier for companies to target us with adverts aimed at our individual desires and fears. That could be useful, helping us to find the products we really need. Or it could expose us to manipulation. We've been talking about just one firm, albeit a huge one, trying to make sense of the data trails we create. There are many others. And if it's not just retailers, but also politicians trying to exploit the power of the algorithm, the implications could be profound. The Inquiry was presented by me, Ruth Alexander, and produced in London by Estelle Doyle and Sarah Shebir. It was mixed by Rod Farker. The editor is Richard Knight. If you want to tell us what you think of this or any of our programmes, we'd love to hear it. You can review us wherever you get your podcasts from, or reach us at Twitter. We're @BBC The Inquiry.